This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديه ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran will switch off 27 online monitoring cameras at its nuclear sites. Hezbollah warning Israel over its illegal gas drilling operation. The movement says it has enough power to stop Israel from plundering Lebanon's wealth. And also coming up, Israel launches an airstrike on the targets of Damascus. Syria says it intercepted the missiles. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has informed the IAEA of its plans to disconnect 27 of the agency's cameras from its nuclear sites.
Basically, what we have been informed is that 27 cameras like this. You remember in December we were showing these cameras on a more auspicious time where we were reinstalling cameras. 27 cameras are being removed in Iran, apart from an online enrichment monitoring system that we have over there.
Rafael Grossi said Iran will remove the extra surveillance cameras installed under the 2015 deal. He said the presence of the cameras was beyond a comprehensive safeguard agreement, but according to Grossi, some 40 cameras which were installed under the safeguards issues will remain in place. This after Iran switched off two of the IAEA's surveillance cameras, saying that their activity was beyond its commitments under the safeguards agreement. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization has slammed the UN nuclear watchdog for anti-Iran stance, saying that it is fully under the Israeli regime's influence. Mohammad Islami was reacting to his country's relations with the International Atomic Energy Agency and the latest anti-Iran resolution adopted by the IAEA Board of Governors. He said Iran inked a deal with world powers and accepted restrictions on its peaceful nuclear programs in order to build trust. He said the latest move at the IAEA is contrary to Iran's goodwill gestures. Islami also expressed regret that the agency's reputation is being thrown into question because it is being exploited by the Israeli regime. He added that the IAEA and other international bodies have become hostages to the Zionists. Iran's president says Tehran stands firm on its positions with regards to the anti-Iranian resolution adopted by the IAEA. Ebrahim Raisi said Iran will not back off a single step from its positions. Raisi said Iran's development in various sectors is not tied to its enemies' reactions. The UN nuclear agency approved a resolution which accuses Tehran of inadequate cooperation. On Wednesday, the agency passed a resolution submitted by the U.S. and three European allies. Iran condemned the move, saying that the countries that pushed for the resolution put their agenda ahead of the agency's credibility. Tehran also held those countries responsible for the consequences. Moving on, members of the anti-Iran terrorist group MKO have attacked a reporter and accompanying news team of Press TV while reporting on an exhibition held in Stockholm on the group's crimes. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
This is the moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
Earlier, we were joined by historian and social activist Osley Jakeshi, and he says members of the MKO group have a long history of terrorist activities against democratic institutions and free speech.
This is not the first attack that the MKO is doing against the free media. They have a long history of terrorist activities and attack against democratic institutions. The Mujahideen al-Halq terrorist organization, in the past they have even killed American officials, and the very nature of this cult is against democracy and free speech. Since their coming or their massive coming to Albania in 2016, the Mujahideens, they have attacked dozens of Albanian journalists and medias. They have attacked and beaten journalists from Channel 4, a British channel, and they have verbally abused and attacked The Guardian, The Independent, the BBC, and Al Jazeera. So what happened today in Sweden is nothing new from this cult. This cult, they do not accept debate, they do not accept opposing views, because they live in a totalitarian cult-like society. For people who know the organization of the Mujahideen al-Halq cult in Albania, they know that these people, they abuse even their own members. Their members, who are held as slave soldiers in Albania, they are not allowed to contact their families, they are not allowed to surf the internet, or they are not even allowed to communicate with the outside world.
Moving on, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has urged Israel to stop extracting gas from the maritime fields in disputed waters.
The objective should be to prevent the enemy from extracting oil and gas from the Karsh gas field and to stop this activity that will and may have begun. The resistance will not stand by and do nothing in the face of Israel's looting of Lebanon's natural wealth, the looting of Lebanon's treasure, which is the only hope for the salvation of the Lebanese people. It will not stand idly by.
Nasrallah described Israel's operation in the disputed waters as an act of provocation. He also warned a Greek company hired by Israel against proceeding with its activities. Nasrallah said the company is a partner in the Israeli aggression and urged the firm to pull out its ship immediately. The Hezbollah chief said Lebanon has the right to extract natural resources from that field, stressing that the movement has the capacity to prevent Israel from extracting gas there. At the weekend, the Israeli floating gas production unit arrived in the disputed maritime zone. The move sparked anger of the Lebanese government, which warned Israel against any aggressive actions. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mayim Sali, tells us more about Hezbollah's stance on the dispute with Israel. She says the movement has compared the dispute with Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon and has called on the people and officials to be united.
It seems Hezbollah is eyeing the situation quite closely. And what we have from Hezbollah right now is a quite official statement from its side. Of course, they said they will not take part. They will not interfere in any of the demarcation process. But he also called on the officials to be united. And he also called on the Lebanese people to be united behind this national cause, which is very significant. He compared this new phase that Lebanon is entering right now to the 1982 Israeli invasion, which reached the capital Beirut. So this is quite significant when it comes to what the nation is looking at right now. We're looking at natural resources that could be looted at any moment, even if the ship does stand in disputed areas, not in areas that are Lebanese, but they have the capability to basically suck out all the natural resources that are across the coastal line of Lebanon. Now, the ship that reached the near the field of Karish is, yes, UK-based, as you mentioned, but it's also owned by a Greek-Israeli. So that also gives Hezbollah leverage. Of course, he had clearly warned that ship that they need to leave the area, that as long as this is called disputed by the Lebanese government, then therefore they should not have the right, just as Lebanon does not have the right.
Israel has conducted yet another airstrike on Syria, this time on the south of the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government says it was a missile attack and left a civilian injured. It said the missiles were fired from the occupied Golan Heights. The Syrian air defenses downed most of them. The attack caused material damage, too. Israel frequently attacks Syria, but rarely claims responsibility. Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out the attacks to aid terrorist groups fighting the Syrian army. Syria says the Israeli raids violate its sovereignty and territorial integrity and has repeatedly complained to the UN over these attacks. A white U.S. police officer who fatally shot a black man during a traffic stop in the state of Michigan 2 months ago is now charged with second-degree murder. That, according to the state's authorities.
Based on his investigation, based on everything he has provided to me, I've made the decision to charge Christopher Scherr with one count of second-degree murder. Second-degree murder is a felony offense and is punishable by up to life in prison with the possibility of parole. As it stands now, this is merely an allegation, and as with any defendant, he is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law.
The prosecuting attorney said the cop has turned himself in to authorities and will be brought to court on Friday. Christopher Scherr killed a 26-year-old black man, Patrick Loyoya, on April 4th. Scherr held his gun to the back of Loyoya's head and fired after pulling him over and asking for his driver's license. That is what investigations show. Footage also shows that Loyoya did nothing wrong, just resisting and asking why he was stopped. His killing once again sparked outrage at the long-lasting and long-standing issue of police brutality and discrimination against black Americans. The U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee investigating last year's Capitol attack has opened its hearings. They probe whether former President Donald Trump subverted the Constitution by encouraging supporters to attack the Congress building over election fraud. The Thursday hearing was the first of six by the House committee. It presented video and testimony of public statements from Trump's close allies. They included his daughter, Ivanka, and his chief of staff, Attorney General William Barr. Trump's allies rejected his claims of fraud in the 2020 presidential election won by his rival Joe Biden. The committee's chairman, Benny Thompson, a Democrat, said the January 6th attack was the culmination of an attempted coup and was Trump's last stand. Trump's supporters attacked the Capitol when Congress was clarifying and certifying Biden's victory. The attack left several people dead. Asian shares opened lower following plunges in U.S. stock markets as traders gear up for a government report on inflation. Japan's Nikkei fell 1.2%. Shares in Hong Kong and South Korea dropped at least 1.5%. Markets in the U.S. were in the red as well. The Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, fell about 2%, and that is while the S&P Index dropped 2.5%. The U.S. government is due to release new data on inflation later on Friday. It is likely to show another jump in consumer prices. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank has said that next month it will deliver its first interest rate rise since 2011 to tackle inflation. That has added to investors' worries, too. The European Central Bank has confirmed its intention to hike interest rates at the policy meeting next month. The move is aimed at bringing down soaring prices across the eurozone. Jeremy Hughes reports.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by 0.25% next month, most likely 0.5% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, you kind of, the cost of living is high already, and then so it's if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, like calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I have also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then?
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
In the limelight.
An audit released by the state of Florida recently suggests that information that the state released to the public during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic was inaccurate and incomplete. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading State Audit Reveals Florida Undercounted COVID Deaths by Thousands. Here's the story. An audit released by the state of Florida on Monday, June 6, suggests that information that the state released to the public during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic was inaccurate and incomplete. The report conducted over the past year by the Florida Auditor General examined the state's COVID-19 response from March to October 2020. The audit reviewed a sample of tests from three separate state-run facilities in its investigation and ultimately came to the conclusion that data on case and death counts frequently went unreported, and that the state often failed to adhere to protocols regarding the virus. State contracted labs, for example, failed to return results for around 60% of the tests that were administered during that 8-month period. Of the results that were returned, many didn't include critical demographic information. Failing to record a person's ethnicity 60% of the time and failing to account for their race more than half of the time. Auditors also found that the state didn't conduct contact tracing for 23% of the positive cases it identified. Put another way, close to 1 in 4 Floridians who tested positive for coronavirus during the early months of the pandemic were never told they had the virus in their systems, the audit concluded. Even when people were notified of their positive results, many weren't alerted until well after they got tested, in some cases more than a week later. The audit also found that Florida officials had undercounted deaths in the state. More than 3,000 additional COVID-19-related deaths were reported by physicians than were on the state's official list of total deaths during the first 8 months of the pandemic. The Florida Auditor General also said in the report that the state failed to conduct routine checks on data collection to ensure accuracy in their numbers. When discrepancies were found, there was no follow-up, the report said. The conclusions in the report confirm that many Floridians were warning about early on in the pandemic, when Governor Ron DeSantis and other right-wing lawmakers were claiming that businesses and other entities were safe enough to reopen despite instituting few statewide precautionary measures to address the continued presence of coronavirus. In the first year of the pandemic, for example, the state restricted local medical examiners from publishing their own numbers on COVID-19 deaths after their numbers conflicted with the state's official reports. A state employee named Rebecca Jones, who was in charge of updating infection numbers across the state, was fired after she alleged that the numbers were being manipulated. DeSantis frequently downplayed the dangers of the virus and even made campaign materials that were critical of national health officials who implored people to take the pandemic more seriously. The U.S. state of Florida is currently seeing an increase in case numbers, reporting nearly 10,000 new cases of COVID-19 per day over the past 2 weeks. More than 74,700 Floridians have died due to coronavirus since the pandemic began more than 2 years ago, a figure that's equivalent to the entire population of Daytona Beach.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Iran urged Greece last week to cooperate in resolving the crisis of Iran seizing two Greek oil tankers without U.S. interference, which came in retaliation to Greece seizing an Iranian tanker off the shores of Greece. Tehran seized the two tankers on Friday after Athens seized the Iranian-flagged tanker Pegas in April. The United States, which imposes strict sanctions on Iran, demanded Greece to cease the shipment of Iranian oil, and Greece delivered. U.S. and Greek diplomats called on Iran to immediately release the two tankers, their cargoes, and crews. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the United States stood to support its NATO ally Greece in the face of this unjustified detention. I kid you not, he literally said that after his country had seized an Iranian oil tanker 2 months prior. Spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh did not let that just pass. Khatibzadeh suggested that Blinken should realize that the time when the United States unilaterally imposed its conditions over the world is over, calling Washington the biggest disruptor of free trade in the world. Khatibzadeh then accused the Greek government of taking orders from a third party, but then reiterated that the relations between Iran and Greece must remain based on good intentions. Naval commandos of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps decided to take action as diplomacy developed and seized two Greek oil tankers that were sailing Friday evening in the Persian Gulf waters near the Iranian coast. This retaliation reflects two main issues. The first, Iran sends a strong message to Greece, America, and the European Union countries that it will react in similarity and immediately to any aggression targeting its tankers in international waters, inside or outside its territories. Second issue is that the nuclear negotiations between Iran, the United States, and other European countries in Vienna are on the verge of collapse, and what remains is the official declaration of the failure of the talks. It is ironic that Greece, which was the initiator of the aggression and seized the Iranian tanker Pegas and 19 Russian sailors from its crew, described Iran's detention of its two tankers, which carry about 2 million barrels of oil, as an act of piracy and a violation of international law by Iran. However, Greece in international waters at American request and legal act, and it has nothing to do with piracy. Ladies and gents, behold the Western height of arrogance, lying, and hypocrisy that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has come to put an end to. Welcome to the Middle East stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In a quick response to the United States' confiscation of a shipment of Iranian oil off the coast of Greece, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps seized two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. Tehran accuses Athens of helping the United States seize an Iranian oil tanker over alleged sanction violations in the Mediterranean. The raid marks the first major incident at sea in months as tensions remain high between Iran and the West over its tattered nuclear deal with world powers. To discuss this issue with us from Athens is Lamprini Thoma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thank you very much for being with us, Lamprini. It's always a pleasure. So, Lamprini, let us begin with what Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps did last week by seizing a Greek oil tanker in retaliation to what Athens did by assisting the United States of America to seize an Iranian oil tanker off the shore of Greece last April in the Mediterranean Sea. Now, Washington's pretext for this sort of piracy against Iran is allegedly that Iran had violated Washington's crushing sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Why did Greece choose to take a side in this dilemma, knowing that it might risk its own tankers that are passing through the Persian Gulf?
Oh, Greece, the current government acts more or less like a protectorate of the U.S. The current prime minister acts unilaterally in many areas and often goes above and beyond our contractual obligations in EU and NATO, because we are members, unfortunately, or even whatever the U.S. is asking. We lack an independent foreign policy. We don't even have a vigilant foreign ministry. The foreign minister is often second-guessed by the prime minister. In this instance, things are even more complicated because the government decided to stand against the most financial strong part of the Greek elite, the ship owners. Greek ship owners control 25% of shipping around the world, mm-hmm. about 15% of all cargo ships, meaning a net worth of over $50 billion. Especially in transporting LNG, they own the biggest fleet in the world, and they have 58% of shipping in their hands in the EU. Mm-hmm. So the government endangered their business worldwide and in the Persian Gulf, which also made their insurance costs go through the roof right now. Mm-hmm. The PM wasn't even concerned about that because he had put, as they say, all his eggs in one basket. And he's either naive to believe that the U.S. will support us if we face a warm episode with Turkey, or, as rumors have it, has a personal agenda and sees himself as the possible next Secretary General of NATO.
Well, that seems like a lot of interest there, or a conflict of interest, if I may. But in your article, you published an article on Saturday, June 4, where you say that Greek lawyers note that Greece's legal aid agreement with the U.S. Only applies to acts that both sides recognize as a crime. And since the EU and Greece do not consider the Iranian army as a terrorist entity the same way the U.S. does, then the Greek court's decision is absurd to allow such piracy off the coast of Greece, meaning that the court order is actually illegal under international law. Do you think that the Greek government will be held accountable for allowing this act of aggression, or rather you think that a diplomatic solution might actually be attained afterwards?
We all hope, the common people, we all hope for a diplomatic solution. And I must say that most Greeks are ashamed for what happened. And this was the sense in social media, in the comments on the press. But with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sidestepped, who is going to work for a diplomatic solution? That's our main problem. Mm-hmm. And our only hope, and this by itself is a travesty of justice, is that the ship owners will make the government understand how big a mistake it was for the Greek interest under international law and under any sense of morality, really. Not to mention that Iran was the only country which gave to Greece oil on credit up to 700 million euros when we were not able to pay a few years ago due to the crisis. Mm-hmm. Also, Iran is a country that has historically stood by Cyprus' rights in the international organizations. So it's a very difficult situation. Even certain Greek laws were bypassed, I have to say, in stealing this oil. For example, it's not allowed to do so in the port of Caristos, where the transfer happened. And it was reported that the Coast Guard revolted against it. But the government did it anyway. Plus, our independent inspection body against money laundering has said that the Iranian tanker shall be left to continue its trip as all paperwork was fine. So I think that Iran has to go legally against Greece here. That was what the Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs said to Greece. Mm-hmm. You have to go the legal route. And we were the first ones, unfortunately, to do the piracy. Well, so we have to do it. Yes.
We did hear him as well, but when he said that, when he tried to condemn Greece for this act, he also said that it is very vital that we keep good intentions between both countries. And here I come about what you wrote in your article, because after this incident, what happened is that after this incident, Iran addresses not the Greek government, but it's addressing Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis' bosses. This is what they are saying. This is what the Iranian media even is referring to, that because a spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry told Blinken, the U.S. foreign minister, that Washington was the, and I quote, disruptor of free trade in the world, the main disruptor of free trade in the world. And that, and I quote again, that the time for the United States to decide on its own is over. If this issue is not resolved anytime soon, Lamprini, how do you think Iran's options will be to retain what it belongs to her?
Hopefully, because of the support, diplomatic solution will be found, given the confiscation of the two Greek tankers also, because it's 1 to 2, and those two are of very powerful people. This counter-confiscation was the message that such actions have consequences, a fact that the Greek government was apparently oblivious to. Hopefully the tanker will be returned to Iran and the two Greek tankers will be sent back in exchange. And hopefully the wonderful way that the Iranians are treating the sailors, the people working on those ships, will be an example for us here too, because it's the same for the people that were on the Iranian tanker here.
And the public, one last thing in 30 seconds, the public sentiment towards what's going on between Iran and Greece. What are the people in Athens saying?
People in Athens believe that we did something very bad. The moral part is what they see, and they're against the government for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the general feeling that you have. Everybody says that. It was the first time that even trolls didn't talk against us when we wrote about what happened.
Well, it seems that if the people are actually on the good side of this, then most definitely this will end in a good way, hopefully, for both countries. I want to thank you very much, Lamprini Thoma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thanks a million for being our guest on this segment. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Erdogan's dream to annex more Syrian land.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
More than a week after Ankara launched a media and political campaign in search of a deal that would allow it to annex more Syrian land under the pretext of fighting Kurdish forces, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan lowered the expectations that had risen dramatically to talk about two small enclaves in the countryside of northern Aleppo that fall under the supervision of Russia. Thus, Erdogan throws the ball into Moscow's court, in the context of the negotiating game he is playing to exploit the war in Ukraine, while the Syrian Kurdish separatists SDF appear to be facing a new difficult test as all eyes turn towards how this deal will be played out. Erdogan seeks more land occupation in Syria in this following report.
After a phone call between the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the Russian President Vladimir Putin, during which the two sides discussed many files related to the war in Ukraine, the food crisis facing the world, in addition to the situation in northern Syria, Erdogan announced in a speech to the deputies of the Justice and Development Party in Parliament that the target of the next phase of Turkish military operations in Syria is Manbij and Tel Rifat in the countryside of Aleppo. The new Turkish statements, which significantly lowered expectations, came after a round of diplomatic negotiations between Turkey, the United States, and countries in the European Union as part of the ongoing Western efforts to double the pressure on Russia by including Sweden and Finland in NATO. While Washington provided Ankara during those negotiations with great facilities, including working to revive the F-16 deal that it had suspended when it took a firm stance towards a new Turkish military operation in Syrian areas inhabited by Kurdish separatists. In the face of the course of events, the Turkish president's choice of the Membish and Tel Rifat areas in particular appears to bypass Ankara's failure to obtain American facilities, knowing that the two areas have been the subject of controversy since the SDF took control of them in 2016 with Russian air cover. The subsequent Russian-Turkish agreements, during which Ankara pledged to take effective steps in Idlib, northwest Syria, by isolating what it refers as Kurdish terrorists and working to open the Aleppo-Latakia road, while Moscow pledged to monitor the activity of the Kurds and ensure that they do not take Membij and Tel Rifat as a launching pad for any attacks. During the past 2 years, in parallel with Washington's withdrawal from certain areas in Syria and the concentration of its occupation forces in the oil areas, the Turkish president tried to pressure again to control Membij and Tel Rifat. The SDF relies heavily on Membij to carry out large commercial transactions related to oil smuggling operations to and from the north and northwest of Syria, in addition to the smuggling of Turkish goods. Despite Russia's toughness on the ground, Moscow's political position seemed softer than that of its American counterpart regarding the Turkish desire to annex areas inside Syria, which appears to be related to the agreement signed between the two parties, in which Russia has expressed more than once its concern about Turkey's delay in implementing its pledges in Idlib. This brings the overall Russian-Turkish understandings to the fore once again and puts the SDF before a difficult test in the area of Tel Rifat and Membij, where it will find itself again demanding to hand over the two areas to the Syrian army, which would cut off Turkey's road to them and enable Russia to implement its pledges to protect them. However, this step is still closely related to the Idlib file, in which any tangible progress will lead to similar progress in Membij and Tel Rifat. Faced with this equation and considering the absence of the American presence in the last two regions and the increase in Turkish pressure, the Kurds who seek American support and whose relationship with Russia is experiencing a chill due to falling into the arms of Washington are in a seriously difficult position.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Berlin is founder of Syriana Analysis YouTube channel and news website, Kevork Almasyan. Thank you very much, my good friend, for being with us today to discuss this issue, because weeks of propaganda and media frenzy, if I may, in Turkey concerning the so-called safe zone in Syria. And yet now we see Erdogan seeking new negotiations with Russia concerning just a couple of towns, but they are Syrian towns in the northern part of Aleppo, Membij and Tel Rifat. But what changed Erdogan's mind right now?
Thank you very much, Mauro, for having me. This is a very old Turkish plan in Syria. Apparently, since the eruption of the CIA regime war on Syria, Turkey had eyes on Aleppo and Mosul. And we remember how the ISIS, al-Nusra, and other terror groups expanded in these areas and also expanded the Turkish influence over these regions. But after 2015 and 2016, when ISIS was defeated, thanks to the Syrian army, the Russian forces, Iranians, and the Lebanese forces in the region, Turkey has changed its plan, especially in the northern part of Syria, that they want to create the so-called safe zones. And these safe zones are basically areas of influence for Turkey. And they want to create these areas for multiple reasons. One, they want to send back the Syrian refugees. I think there are around 4 million Syrian refugees in Turkey to this area. So therefore, they have to change the demographics of this area, kick out the people who lived there for centuries, and they resettle the type of people Erdogan wants to send them in these areas, and those who are more loyal to Erdogan. And these areas are subjected to Turkification because they are Turkish schools, and people are who are born there, they go to Turkish schools, learn Turkish language, deal with Turkish currency. Therefore, they would be Turkified. And this has happened under the Ottoman Empire as well a few centuries ago, right? And now Erdogan wants to create this belt to resettle the refugees, and two, to Turkify it, and three, he will call in the future a referendum, and he will say these people want to join the Turkish Turkey. And this is his plan. Therefore, Russia has now intervened, and they are negotiating with the Turkish side. However, the Russian side position is not really strong when it comes to Erdogan, because Russia also needs Turkish neutrality, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, when it comes to Ukraine, because Erdogan can inflict more damage to Russia right now than he used to be previously in the Ukrainian case, if he, for example, blocks the Bosphorus in front of the Russian
or
Navy.
Or if he allows Sweden and Finland to enter to NATO,
exactly,
which means he has now cards in his hands to play and negotiate with Russia. But he told reporters last week, I'm saying Erdogan told reporters, we will launch a campaign against them and we must do it. Is he referring to the Kurdish natives, Syrian nationals living in the areas that he wants to annex? Or is he also seeking some sort of an open engagement with the Syrian Arab army as well?
Marwa, I believe the Kurdish militia presence is just an excuse for Erdogan to intervene. Even before the Kurdish presence there, there was no Kurdish presence in Aleppo, there was no Kurdish presence in Idlib, but there are Turkish forces in these areas, right? Mm-hmm. So this is just an excuse. Unfortunately, Syria, the Syrian army will not engage directly with Turkey in this regard, because Turkey is a NATO member. And they will activate, I think, Article 6 of the NATO Charter in order to call for the United States and other superpowers to intervene on the side of Turkey, right? So it's a very complicated situation. I think Turkey will not target Syrian army positions directly. Maybe in certain positions, posts, yes, but it will not be, let's say, a full, like a big war between both sides. Russia will be in the middle, will try to minimize the damages for Syria. Unfortunately, Syria's leverage is not that big in this file, and Russia is preoccupied with the Ukrainian war. Therefore, Syria's position is not really strong. So we have to take this into consideration when it comes to geopolitical conflicts in the region. And we have to wait also for the Ukrainian war. Syria is also waiting for the outcome of the Ukraine war, when Russia comes out as victorious, as Damascus hopes for. And after that, the position of Russia will be stronger when it comes to the eastern shores of the Euphrates against the Americans, and also with Turkey, because Turkey will not have the same cards to blackmail, let's say, Russia when the war is over.
So what you're saying, Gevorg, is this is a particularly favorable geopolitical moment for Erdogan here, because Russia is preoccupied with the war in Ukraine, and with Russia being a major player inside of Syria, it is focusing its attention and its resources towards what's going on in neighboring Ukraine. But how realistic is this approach towards a possible escalation inside Syria? Because also Erdogan does not really have that much of a power inside of his own nation anymore, coming up with the elections next year. So he is also in a conundrum. He doesn't want a war, but on the same side, he doesn't want to lose any land inside of Syria. So where is that putting him?
Erdogan, despite all our reservations about him, he is very clever, and he is a very good chess player, and he's a merchant. He's doing his bazaar in the past at least 10 years in Syria, especially when it comes to areas that were occupied by the terrorists. So he's exchanging certain geographics, like I take this part, I give you that part. And this is a very, let's say, a dangerous game for Turkey as well, because in my opinion, if Turkey succeeds, or Erdogan succeeds in his plan, he will be re-elected. And the so-called neo-Ottomanism will continue in the region, and therefore we will have more troubles in the region. But he may also fall in the next elections if he doesn't succeed completely in Syria, because the economic situation is very dire in Turkey, and there is a very huge pressure on the Turkish people by the influx of the refugees. Of course, there are millions of refugees that could add pressure on the economy, but there is a big propaganda by the Turkish side to against the refugees. They want to kick them out from Syria, from Turkey. They are spreading negative sentiments towards them, racism, and we can see lots of assaults against Syrian refugees in Turkey, and this is all state-sponsored and state media-sponsored attacks because of the racism that they embraced in the past few months. And therefore, Erdogan desperately wants regions in Syria that are not controlled by the Syrian government to send hundreds of thousands of refugees, or to start sending them against their will to these areas, and later to capture these areas.
Well, that would seem like I don't know, some sort of a complicated plan, because they all might actually turn against him if they don't like what's going on and they don't like that plan. But that's the time that we have. Kevork, it's always a pleasure having you on board the Middle East stream. Kevork Almasyan from Berlin, founder of Syriana Analysis YouTube channel and news website. Thanks a million for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week, because we have much more interesting things again next week on the Middle East stream.
In the limelight.
A broken prime minister is still in occupation of Downing Street thanks to a billionaire class who holds a stranglehold over the governing political party, says Peter O'Born, author, in an article published under the heading Boris Johnson, the billionaire's useful idiot. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Welcome to British Politics This Overcast. A broken prime minister is still in occupation of Downing Street and determined to stay there. This is a recipe for, at best, paralysis, at worst, chaos. More likely both. It's hard to see what will make Boris Johnson quit. The prime minister, remember, has powerful allies. Tuesday's Daily Mail, Britain's most well-drilled and powerful popular paper, is an essential read for anyone wishing to understand the near-term trajectory of British politics. It contains a series of brutal hatchet jobs on former Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, Theresa May in trousers, who the Mail accuses of leading the plotters. On its front page, the Mail lacerates the 148 Tory rebels for pressing the self-destruct button by opening the door to smirking Starmer's coalition of chaos. The big newspaper prop writers, Murdoch, Rodermere, and the Barclay family, remain loyal to Johnson. Admittedly, the Times and the Telegraph are tougher than usual on Johnson this morning, but crucially, there are no calls for him to quit. Murdoch, Mail newspapers, and the Barclays are part of Johnson's core political base. They all backed him to be Tory leader, all backed him in the 2019 general election, and all have protected Johnson during the harrowing political scandals that have dogged his premiership. These newspaper magnates are still behind the prime minister today. While this remains the case, Johnson can hope to survive. The second half of the coalition backing Johnson are the billionaire Tory donors who funded Brexit and now, in a mutation of democratic politics, effectively own Johnson's Conservative Party. in an unprecedented direct intervention by the super-rich in British public life, these donors came together in defense of Johnson. They wrote a letter significantly given as an exclusive to Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper, awarding their unconditional support to Boris Johnson. As the Sun emphasized, this letter was signed by some of the richest men in Britain, including billionaire J.C.B. Boss Lord Bamford, property magnate Sir Tony Gallagher, and Corfon warehouse founder David Ross. Other names reported the Sun include multi-millionaire financier Howard Shore and mega-rich Simon Rubin, who alongside brother David is worth £116 billion. The letter, which emphasized the talking points of Johnson's political campaign, announced that Johnson enjoyed the unwavering support of the billionaires who signed it. The authors of the letter seem to have felt no need to say out loud the unspoken threat that they would withhold funds from any Tory leader who dared to supplant Johnson. But the Johnson campaign team felt no such inhibitions. Johnson loyalist Nadine Dorries, Secretary of State for Culture, Media,